has a girlfriend, Cassie, who is really Caleb's girlfriend. She is unaware of the distinction. The four of us are at dinner. Jacob, pretending to be Caleb, and I are holding hands. Caleb, pretending to be Jacob, and Cassie are holding hands. There is a light in his eyes that isn't there when he looks at me. My husbands are finishing each other's sentences, regaling Cassie and me with stories about a particularly difficult client. Jacob orders another bottle of wine, and we continue to drink and talk and practice being normal. His arm is heavy across my shoulders, and every once in a while he leans in and brushes his wet lips against the spot on my neck that makes my back arch sharply. Then he smiles at his brother, and his brother smiles back. This is when they are at their best, when they are together, sharing the same moment. There is safety for them, in the number two. Cassie is a graduate student in museum studies. Caleb told me this in bed after she and Jacob first started dating. He told me about how Cassie plans to curate modern art exhibits, how she has a unique aesthetic, how he thinks she may be the one for Jacob. But what he's really telling me is that she's the one for him. I lay next to Caleb, let him talk, traced his father's image with my fingernails. I told him I was happy for Jacob, but I was really happy for him. When it's time to settle the check, Cassie and I go to the bathroom, and we eye each other in the mirror as we freshen our lipstick. "It must be hard being married to a twin," she says. I start to think that she may be smarter than I thought. I say, "It's like being married to two men." Jacob takes me home, while Caleb takes Cassie to Jacob's house, five houses down from ours. In the middle of the night, they will switch places, and I will know, because Caleb will smell like another woman. Cassie won't notice, because she's the kind of woman who doesn't pay attention to details, or who chooses not to pay attention to details. On the drive home, I trace Jacob's knuckles and the tiny scars on his fingers, all from architecture school, making miniature models of grand ideas with sharp knives. I tell him how I wish every night could be like this night. He nods and says, "Let's go for a drive." I lean back in my seat, kick off my heels. Jacob takes me to the site of a project he's working on, and we take the construction elevator to the top floor, his arms wrapped tightly around me as the hoist slowly creaks upward. There's no ceiling yet on the top floor, so when we get out of the elevator, it is disorienting, seeing the city sprawling around us, and nothing keeping us from falling into it. I hold on to Jacob to steady myself, and then I laugh and pull him into a slow waltz, staring up into the night sky. When we stop, the world keeps spinning, so we drop to the concrete floor and sit with our knees pulled against our chests. What I want to say is that I know who he is, and that I would choose him. I would always, forever choose him. But I also know his first love is his brother, so I say nothing. I pull my shirt over my head and slide out of my skirt, and I lie back on the cold floor, gritty with dirt and sawdust. I reach for Jacob and sigh when he lies on top of me. We kiss softly, and he closes his eyes, blowing air along my neck across my shoulders. Then I'm tearing off his shirt, pulling him against me, opening myself to him the way he wants me to. I tell him the only true thing I can. I say, "I love you." When Caleb drinks too much, where too much is anything more than one drink, he forgets the new history he and his brother have cobbled from their memories of their father. After he and Jacob have switched places, Caleb climbs into bed reeking of wine and cigarette smoke. He barks at me to wake up. I pull the sheets over my head because I'm thinking about Jacob and the freedom of tall buildings and falling into stars while the husband I love most is moving over and in me. Caleb pulls the sheets away, turns on the lights. I sit up, shivering, alone with the husband I do not love most. He starts telling me a story about himself and his brother, sitting in the back seat of their father's Cadillac, while the old man got a blowjob from a woman who was not their mother, and how their father had that woman give his sons blowjobs as well. As he tells me this story, his voice grows coarser. His features become less recognizable. Caleb grabs me by my waist, straddles me and slaps my face. "Don't ever do something like that," he says. "Don't be a fucking whore." Then he's flipping me onto my stomach, his unkind hand planted against my skull, holding me to the bed, treating me like the whore he doesn't want me to be. I think about Caleb's cock, slick with Jacob's seed. I think about how much I hate, and therefore love, the husband I'm with, because I pity him, and maybe I pity myself. I come, immoderately. Caleb falls asleep lying on top of me. His body is heavy and damp, his smell unfamiliar. In the morning, Caleb and I avoid making eye contact. He showers, pretends he's going to work, goes to his brother's house, sends Jacob back to me. I'm at my dressing table, trying to mask the angry, purpling bruise spreading across my face. Jacob stands in the doorway and smiles so kindly that I become nauseated. "What are you doing?" he asks. Then he notices the arc of broken blood vessels beneath my eye. His hands clench into tight fists as he approaches me. When he places soft kisses along the edges of the hurt, my face starts to ache more deeply than it ever did beneath Caleb's fist. "I'm so sorry," Jacob says, shouldering the burden of his brother's sins. When I miss my period twice in a row, it is Jacob who finds me in the bathroom, sitting on the edge of the bathtub, wrapped in a bath towel, holding the pregnancy test in one hand. He falls to his knees, folds his hands over my thighs. He smiles, pulls my towel open, leaving me naked, and rests his face against my breasts. I run my fingers through his hair, gently massaging his scalp. I imagine the two of us packing a small suitcase, buying a cheap car, driving west on I-80 until we reach something better. I say, "Do you think your brother will be happy?" He says, "I don't give a damn what my brother thinks." For a while, I allow myself to believe him. I'm 6 months pregnant when Caleb goes to a doctor's appointment with me. He is moody, almost indifferent. There only because Jacob had a meeting he had to attend. These days I mostly see Caleb late at night, when he steals back to his own home, when he is angry and needs something only I can give. He sits in the chair with the hard plastic arms next to the exam table, arms crossed tightly across his chest. As the doctor glides the sonogram wand across the lower round of my belly, she turns a knob on the machine. "Do you hear that?" she asks. The room is silent, but for the identical flutters of two heartbeats. Difficult women. Loose women. Who a loose woman looks up to? Never her mother. She's trying to kill her mother, or at least those parts of her mother lurking beneath her skin. When she spreads her legs, she hopes the distance between her and her mother will gape ever wider. She does this because she remembers too much. She has seen too much. Her mother pale and frail, cowed by the meat of her father, his fleshy body, his fleshy demands. Where a loose woman lives. Her apartment is clean and bright and well-appointed, though her home doesn't look lived in. There are the suggestions of life, but nothing more. She never stays in one place long. She doesn't need to. When gentlemen visit, their deep voices echo throughout all the clean and bright and empty space. There is a print, black and white, in the hall entrance. Sometimes as he's leaving, a gentleman caller will study the print, try to make sense of it. She will watch him, standing nearby, her body wrapped in a soft robe. He'll say, "This is beautiful, but what does it mean?" She will simply smile. How a loose woman longs to be touched. There was a boy she once knew. She was 23, and he was the same age. He was earnest, and she didn't know what to make of that. She had already learned the dangers of sincerity. He told her exactly how he felt. He asked her what she wanted. He touched her with purpose, his hands soft but strong. When she lay beneath him, she arched into his chest willingly, loved the warmth at the places where their bodies met. It was too much. She didn't dare trust it. She broke his heart. When she closes her eyes, she remembers his fingers, tracing the bones of her spine. How a loose woman sits at the bar. Smooth is what they call an ultra lounge. Lots of low leather seating, dim lights, overpriced drinks. Electronica blasts through the speakers at uncomfortable volumes, and there is a dress code, particularly for men, so they always wear their best jackets, sometimes a tie. Their shoes are slick and shiny, just like their hair. They have job titles that often end in the letters ER. Sometimes she goes to the lounge with people who might be considered friends, though they know very little about her. She sits where she can be seen while maintaining an indifference about who actually sees her. She crosses her legs and keeps her calves touching. She doesn't blink. She tries not to make it seem like she cares about anything at all. What a loose woman sees in the mirror. Nothing. She doesn't look. She doesn't need to. She knows exactly who she is. Frigid women. How she got that way. In second grade, she skinned her knee walking home from school in a plaid skirt and Mary Jane's. As she sat on the kitchen counter, watching her mother dab the wound with alcohol to keep it clean, she said. She wanted nothing more than to poke it, to see how much she could make herself hurt. With whom she surrounds herself. She has a husband and a child, and she loves them in her way, though they both like to gang up on her, call her cold. It is her against them. This infuriates her, but she says nothing. She smiles coolly. At night, her husband often tries to reach for her, but she turns on her side, or digs her fingernails into his wrist as she pushes him away. He misunderstands her motives, and when he's golfing with his friends, smoking cigarettes and drinking beer, the stink of which he will bring home, he likes to say the old ball and chain never puts out. He doesn't cheat, mostly because he's a busy man, and he likes his child well enough, but he does frequent strip bars, and he brings the stink of those places home with him, too. At night, there is always a burning in her chest as she tries to hold her breath. What a frigid woman wears. Every day she wakes up at 5 a.m. and runs until her body feels like it might fall apart. Everyone tells her she should run marathons, but she doesn't see the point. She doesn't need to wear a number on her chest to feel validated. She lives in the country. She can run all she wants. She can go longer than 26.2 miles. She can do anything. She runs because she likes it. She runs because she loves her body, the power of it, how it has always saved her when she most needed saving. She loves to wear form-fitting clothing that shows off her musculature, the leanness of her legs, the gentle curves of her calves, the flat of her stomach. When she feels people watching her, she remembers the freedom of running and knows that one day she will just keep going. What happened when her mother died? She was pregnant with her own child, due any day, her body swollen and unfamiliar. There was a phone call, and she stood there afterward, listening to the dial tone, unable to move. The water ran hot in the kitchen sink, and she idly wondered if it would ever stop without human intervention. She drove to the hospital, slowly, her belly pressed painfully against the steering wheel. She didn't answer her phone when her husband called. She found her mother's body, stiff and alone, draped in a blue sheet, so still. She ignored the nurse as she slid next to her mother, her belly pulsing against her mother's cooling skin. So many people came and stared, tried to get her to move, but she did not leave her mother alone. Where a frigid woman goes at night, there are places for people with secrets, and she has secrets. So many of them that sometimes they threaten to choke her. She goes to the places for people with secrets, and there she waits. Crazy women. Why a crazy woman is misunderstood. It started with a phone call after a third date where she followed him home and they had sex, nothing memorable, but overall adequate. They had breakfast at the diner next door. He ate eggs, scrambled, soft. She had pancakes doused in syrup and butter. "I can't believe you're a woman who eats," he said. "You're a goddamn dream." She smiled at him, the scent of maple heavy in her nose. When they said goodbye, they kissed long and hard, bruising their lips together. It was hours later in her own apartment when she remembered she left her briefcase on his couch. She called and he didn't answer, and there were important papers, an iPad. She couldn't just let it go. She kept calling, and he kept not answering. He called his best friend and said, "This crazy bitch is blowing up my phone." She went to his apartment, and when he answered the door, he said, "I've got mad skills." She rolled her eyes, said, "It wasn't that good," and pointed to her briefcase, exactly where she left it. His face reddened as she swept past him, grabbed her briefcase, and walked out, head held high. What a crazy woman talks about in therapy. The therapist's office is small, so small it could drive a woman crazy. When she and her therapist sit across from each other on small couches, their knees practically touch. This makes her cringe, but it can't be helped. She needs someone to talk to. She needs someone to hear her, to understand. She needed help. She has seen many therapists. One told her she was too pretty to have real problems. Another told her to find herself a good man. She knew this therapist wouldn't last long. At the end of her first appointment, after a recitation of all the things that would make anyone crazy, he handed her four pieces of stapled paper, self-care worksheets, and this after she had explicitly told him she didn't believe in affirmation-based therapy. It was the second visit. He asked her if she had completed the worksheets, and she said, "I put a one for everything." He leaned forward. She could see a pattern of dryness on his bald scalp. "You mean to say it never occurs to you to eat regularly?" He stared at her, an eyebrow raised. She never looked away. What a crazy woman thinks about while walking down the street. She tries to walk not too fast and not too slow. She doesn't want to attract any attention. She pretends she doesn't hear the whistles and catcalls and lewd comments. Sometimes she forgets and leaves her house in a skirt or a tank top because it's a warm day, and she wants to feel warm air on her bare skin. Before long, she remembers. She keeps her keys in her hand, three of them held between her fingers like a dull claw. She makes eye contact only when necessary, and if a man should catch her eye, she juts her chin forward, makes sure the line of her jaw is strong. When she leaves work or the bar late, she calls a car service, and when the car pulls up to her building, she quickly scans the street to make sure it's safe to walk the short distance from the curb to the door. She once told a boyfriend about these considerations, and he said, "You are completely out of your mind." She told a new friend at work, and she said, "Honey, you're not crazy. You're a woman." What a crazy woman eats. It is hard to remember the taste of cream, of butter, of salt. In her kitchen, she has a shelf of cookbooks. Light Eating Right, Getting Creative with Kale, Thin Eats, and one very worn copy of The Art of French Cooking. She opens only when her hunger is so gnawing. The only thing that will sate her is to read of veloutés and bouillabaisse. On Sundays, she plans her meals for the week using her cookbooks. It is a dreary process that leaves her tongue dry. Next to the stove, there is a small scale she uses to weigh everything. She understands the importance of precise measurements. What happens when a crazy woman snaps? She is sitting at her desk, working late, when her boss hulks his way into her office, sitting too close, on the edge of her desk, taking up space in the way men do. He stares down her blouse, and it's the presumption in the way he doesn't hide his interest that makes her hold the sharp letter opener in the cool palm of her hand. Mothers. What she sees in her child's face. From the moment the boy was born, he was the spitting image of his father. "Carved right out of that man's ass," her mom, prone to vulgarity, said in the hospital room as she held her first grandson. When she was finally alone, her husband in the cafeteria looking for something to eat, she held her firstborn child and stared at him, eager to see some mark of herself. Eager to feel like the 9 months of carrying him, the bed rest, the way he tore her all the way open, was worth it. She never found what she was looking for. What she says to the other mothers at her child's school. One Wednesday a month, she has to bring a healthy snack to her son's classroom and serve as a helper. Her husband serves on Thursdays. She takes time off from work to do this, and makes up the hours at night after she has put her son to sleep. They call this arrangement flex time, but really, it's stretch time. She has never worked more hours than after she had her son. It's hard to know what healthy means anymore. That's what she thinks each week. She brought peanut butter and crackers once, but one of the other mothers frowned, her lips drawn in a tight line. "Peanut allergies," the other mother muttered. It was all very confusing. For several months, she brought only orange wedges, until yet another mother pulled her aside and said children need variety to thrive. She said, "Don't they get variety during the other days of the week?" It was soon after that she was told she was no longer needed as a classroom aide, and on Wednesday, in her office, when she might have otherwise been in her son's classroom, she felt triumphant. What she thinks about raising a boy. Throughout her pregnancy, she was convinced she would be having a girl. She was ready for that. She was ready to love someone who would have something essential in common with her. When the doctor laid her bloody, mewling son on her chest, when she realized he was not a she, it was such a shock she couldn't speak. She warmed to him because he was a fat baby boy. Everywhere on his body, rolls. She loved to trace them and put powder in the folds of his skin to keep him dry and sweet-smelling. Even his wrists had rolls, and she would kiss them whenever she could. Her husband didn't approve, said too much affection made a boy soft. But she ignored him, because she often spied him doing the exact same thing as he changed the boy's diaper, or put him down for a nap. Where she went when she realized she was pregnant again. After work, nauseated and irritable, she went to the bar where she and her colleagues liked to congregate, because the martinis were stiff and made with gin, the way martinis were supposed to be made. She sat alone, though her friends urged her to join them. She drank one martini after another until she was so drunk she had to call her husband to come get her, which he did. He carried her upstairs and undressed her. He gave her water, 2 aspirin, and held her close, tried to figure out what was wrong. As she fell asleep, she murmured, "I cannot do it again." He wished very much to know what she meant. How a Mother Loves. She and her son like to watch documentaries about wild animals. Mothers are often vicious when protecting their cubs, sharp teeth bared and shiny wet. She wishes she could feel that way about her own child, whom she likes well enough. She understands people will never be as true as animals. Dead girls. Death makes them more interesting. Death makes them more beautiful. It's something about their bodies on display in final repose. Eyes wide open, lips blue, limbs stiff, skin cold. Finally, it might be said, they are at peace. Florida. 3333 Palmetto Crest Circle. The adjustment had been uncomfortable. All her life, Marcy had lived in the Midwest with people who ate red meat and starchy foods, who allowed their bodies to spread without shame. And then her husband was transferred to Naples. Marcy's mother said, "Naples? Like in Italy?" And Marcy said, "No, Florida." And her mother said, "Oh, dear." The women in Naples all looked the same, lean and darkly tan, their faces narrow with hungered discipline, whittled by the same surgeon. They stared at Marcy's relatively ample physique with disgust or envy or something between the two. At night, Marcy worried about her ass and thighs. Her husband always said, "Baby, you are perfect." And she flushed angrily. His assurances were so reflexive as to be insulting. In Omaha, they lived in a neighborhood. In Naples, they moved into a gated community, Palmetto Landing, where each estate was blandly unique and sprawling. Tall facades, lots of glass and balustrades around the windows, Spanish tiles on the roofs. The streets cobbled with tiny square bricks. The first time they drove up to the gatehouse, manned by a white-haired gentleman in polyester, Marcy leaned forward to study the landscaping, tall cypresses encircled by Peruvian lilies looming over the guardhouse. She sighed, said, "This is a bit much." Her husband said, "Baby, people love the illusion of safety and the spectacle of enclosure." They were given bar-coded stickers for their cars. Their community had a country club. They joined because the transfer came with a promotion and a raise. Marcy's husband said it was important to live up to their new station. He mostly wanted to play golf with men whose bellies were fatter than his. In Palmetto Landing, the men's bodies expanded in inverse proportion to those of their wives. Each morning, there was a group fitness class at the clubhouse, spinning, Zumba, kickboxing, always something different. The instructor was a young, aggressively fit woman, Caridad. The other wives loved to say her name, trilling their R's to show Caridad. "Ellas hablan español." Marcy stood in the back of the studio in sweatpants and an old T-shirt of her husband's, while the women around her perspired in their perfectly coordinated outfits, fancier than most of Marcy's wardrobe. Marcy enjoyed the pleasant soreness as she drove the 5 blocks home after each class. She liked how for an hour, there was a precise set of instructions she was meant to follow, a clear sense of direction. The other wives were quietly fascinated by Marcy, in that she was a rare species in the wealthy enclave, a first wife. Ellen Katz, who lived 3 doors down, often squeezed Marcy's shoulder with her cool, bony hand. She'd say, "We're rooting for you," and offered words of encouragement as Marcy's figure slimmed. Marcy never knew what to say during these moments, but she smiled politely, because she understood these people and how they existed only in relation to those around them. 1217 Ridgewood Road, Unit 11.
My wife and I watch documentaries about the lives of extraordinarily fat people so we can feel better about ourselves, because we work hourly jobs and live in a crappy apartment surrounded by McMansions as part of an economic diversity initiative in our gated community. Our GEDs didn't take us as far as we hoped, but they got us to Palmetto Landing. And sometimes we tell ourselves that's enough. We got our GEDs because we wanted to get married. We wanted to get married so we could have sex, because back then, we believed what our parents told us about going to hell if we fornicated. And at that point, we'd done everything but have sex. And we knew that the disposition of our souls was in grave danger if we didn't do something drastic. Our parents told us we couldn't get married until we had our high school diplomas, because we were too young, and we needed a good solid education before we could make adult decisions. And we thought they were delusional, because we actually went to school every day and knew that they weren't teaching us a damn thing. We showed them by going across the state line to get married. But then the sex wasn't that great, and then we couldn't find jobs that didn't involve customer service. And now, we've accepted that this is as good as it's going to get. We watch as the extraordinarily fat people tearfully explain how they got to 1,000 pounds, how it was a slippery slope, how they tried diets, how now they're stuck in their soiled beds and have to be cut out of their homes and taken to a special fat hospital for emergency surgery with the assistance of special fat SWAT teams with good back strength who wear latex gloves and grave expressions. The best part of these documentaries is when the medical professionals talk about the fat people like they understand, like they sympathize, like this is all normal, when you know that when those doctors and nurses get home, they sit in bed crying, eating a tub of ice cream, asking themselves how tragedies like these happen. The wife and I giggle when the doctors use the word staggering, or when the fat person says, "I let things get out of hand." For the next week, we'll repeat that phrase as often as we can, and then laugh uncontrollably. For example, I'll get home late from work and the wife will be at the kitchen table waiting, and she'll be kind of irritated because she took the time to bake a Stouffer's lasagna in the oven and microwave some frozen broccoli. So I'll say, "I let things get out of hand." She'll try not to crack a smile, and then her cheeks will twitch and she'll start shaking, and then we'll both laugh so hard that there's snot coming out of our noses, and we're laugh crying, and she's forgotten that I was late and won't spend the next hour interrogating me about why my shirt reeks like cigarette smoke, even though we both know that I'm late because I met my best friend, whom she hates mostly because he did finish high school and isn't married, for a couple of beers at the bar he owns. The sex between the wife and me has improved significantly over the past 7 years. I think we're starting to resent getting married at 17 a lot less. After we watch documentaries about the lives of extraordinarily fat people, my wife fucks me like she's auditioning to become a contract porn star and tells me she's so fucking glad that we're both thin and that we have families who love us enough not to feed us to death And I tell her I'm so fucking glad we're both thin, and I lick her nipples and get extra creative, and we both moan and pant, and I want the moment to last. So I think about the poor SOB who needs a team of physical therapists to give him a bath, and how he groans in pain as they heave and shift his folds and awkward deposits of fat. All so it will take me a little longer to come. Mornings after, thank God we're not fat sex. The wife and I tend to hate each other a little, so we don't speak and make as little eye contact as possible. Instead, we move silently through our morning routines as we try to assess any damage we may have caused. She brushes her teeth and takes a shower and shaves her legs and uses all the hot water and leaves little tiny leg hairs around the drain and curls her hair and puts on her makeup and forgets to cap her mascara, and the entire time I'm sitting on the toilet pretending to read a magazine. But really, I'm just staring at her naked body because she's hotter than me. She starts the coffee, makes it too strong just the way I hate it, fills her travel thermos, leaves for a job as a receptionist at a beauty salon. And I get to spend an hour or so alone in our apartment watching Home Shopping Network until I have to go to work at a copy shop where I spend my day in front of a Xerox machine, pushing buttons, flirting with college girls who need photocopies, and just can't seem to work the machine while getting high on hot toner fumes. Invariably, at some point during these documentaries about extraordinarily fat people, there comes a time when a surgeon has to cut away chunks of belly or upper thigh, and the fat person is lying on the operating table, vulnerable and spread eagle, unconscious as the surgeon uses special tools to spread and pull and dissect. Then the surgeon triumphantly raises the bloody, excised body parts and shouts out how much they weigh, and everyone in the room gasps, frenzied-like. It's painfully obvious that they're all really turned on. And after they're done sewing their patient back together like they're Dr. Frankenstein, you get the impression that one of those surgeons is going to pull one or more of those nurses into a supply closet so that they too can have, thank God we're not fat sex. The wife doesn't like to watch the operations. She calls it human butchering, and blood makes her nauseated. She doesn't even like to change her own tampon, so when we're watching the surgical procedures, the wife covers her eyes and buries her head against my shoulder. And I narrate in explicit detail how the fat is yellow and serpentine and pulpy and slick, and how the excised body parts are dropped into biohazard bags. And then we speculate about what happens to the dead fat deposits of extraordinarily fat people. And we think it would be nice if they had backyard burial ceremonies for them, the way kids do for dead pets. One night, when we're watching one of these documentaries, the wife turns to me and says, "There's no happy endings in these stories." And then she swallows about half of my beer. She looks like she's about to cry. And then I feel like I'm about to cry, thinking about these large people living such small, impossible lives. So I say, "It's a happy ending when they're wheeled out of the hospital and they only weigh 500 pounds, and they go back to their special chair at home where their loved ones will feed them the same way they've always fed them, so that in 3 years they'll weigh a ton again and we'll have another documentary to watch." And with tears in her eyes, my wife crawls into my lap, straddling me, and she holds my face in her hands, and she says, "I love you so fucking much." 2945 Palmetto Hollow Circle. Jean Richard and Elsie Moreau had lived in Palmetto Landing for nearly 7 years when they heard the news by way of Ellen Katz that another Haitian family was moving into the community. Doctors, 3 children, 2 still at home, new money and a lot of it. Ellen was giddy as she delivered the news. She saw it as something of a personal responsibility to keep her neighbors abreast of such developments. They sat on the lanai, drinking wine, sweating quietly. Ellen pointed at Elsie. "I imagine you'll want to invite the new family over, perhaps dinner, something from home." Elsie took a careful sip of her wine, then twisted the heavy diamond on her finger as she sank into her seat. Why would you imagine that? She murmured. A few weeks later, Elsie was driving her golf cart to the clubhouse for ladies' golf, slowly bouncing along the cobbled street when she saw a light-skinned brown woman standing at the edge of her driveway, one hand shielding her eyes from the sun. Elsie immediately knew the woman was one of the new Haitian doctors. Elsie could recognize her people anywhere. It was a point of pride. She stared straight ahead, the electric motor of her golf cart humming softly as she drove past. Jean Richard was the more sociable one, willing to do more than his fair share of maintaining their position within the community. Always gregarious and outgoing at the various functions, so many functions, barbecues and theme nights and bridge and the like. If he had his way, they would spend every night with their friends at the clubhouse. Elsie preferred more control over the boundaries of her world. She was in her late 40s. She had no need for new friends. At dinner, Elsie mentioned she had seen the Haitian doctor wife standing in her driveway. "We should have them over. Welcome them," Jean Richard said, rubbing his heavy hands together. Elsie frowned, tried to swallow her sigh. "We left that island for a reason, and you know what the neighbors would think." Jean Richard leaned forward, but thought better of saying anything. Instead, he smiled, said, "Oui, ma chère." It had been 25 years since Elsie immigrated to the United States. What she remembered of home was the promiscuity. Always people, everywhere, hot and clamoring. Elsie did not often think of the towering palm trees, or the bright blue water, or trips to the country to visit her grandmother, or how much she loved her blue school uniform, or watching her parents dance in the small courtyard behind their home. Her sharpest memories were of her 8 brothers and sisters always crowding any space she tried to make for herself. She remembered small rooms and heavy air, and warm concrete walls and slick skin and limbs, stretching desperately for a cooler, dry place. 1217, Ridgewood Road, Unit 8. Caridad loved her body, the strength and shape of it. She did not much love how other people loved her body. They misunderstood. She worked as a fitness instructor at a country club in a gated community in Naples. It was a good job. Mostly she helped old people forget how little time they had left, and helped not yet old people keep aging at bay. Vanity was an easy thing to understand. During group fitness classes, Caridad watched the women in the community wearing their outfits that cost more than her weekly pay, how their makeup shimmered the more they perspired, how their perfume filled the studio, choking the air out of the room. They were always trying to outdo each other, to master the complex moves Caridad modeled for them. She had a soft spot for the women in the back row, often young, the kind with new money and older husbands who didn't yet know where they fit in the ecosystem of the neighborhood, the kind she might be friends with under different circumstances. Sometimes after class, Caridad tried to talk to the women in the back row, but they were often apprehensive about upsetting the delicate balance demanded of them, the unspoken rules about associating with the right kind of people. It had been a long day. In her morning fitness class, the ladies were unfocused, unable to follow simple moves, complaining each time Caridad tried to increase the intensity. "Por favor, Caridad," they said. "No mas." The ladies in her classes loved to speak to Caridad in broken Spanish, to show her they were comfortable with her ethnicity, despite the paleness of their skin and the wealth of their husbands. Each morning before work, Caridad stared at her reflection in the mirror and practiced not rolling her eyes, so she could smile politely at the ladies in her classes. One of the community's newest residents lingered in the studio after the Zumba class. She was young, and the only one who didn't wear coordinated designer outfits. Caridad couldn't remember her name, The woman was married to an age-appropriate man and would never be accused of being able to follow a beat. But she wasn't afraid to sweat or look ugly. Caridad walked the length of the studio, picking up discarded water bottles. "How are you enjoying the neighborhood?" she asked. The woman offered a small smile, waving her hands in front of her. "This all takes a little getting used to." Caridad arched an eyebrow. "I can imagine." "I'm Marcy," she said, closing the distance between them, holding her hand out. "This isn't who we are, my husband and I. I have no idea what we're doing here." "I'm guessing he's a golfer," Marcy laughed. "Mostly in his mind." It would be nice to go out for a drink after work, Caridad thought. She wouldn't mind someone nice to talk to. Caridad was about to invite Marcy out for a drink when one of the white hairs who shared the same face as several of her friends popped into the studio. "Yoo-hoo, Marcy, we're ready for lunch," she said. Marcy shrugged apologetically and shuffled out of the studio. Caridad sighed. Later, after a personal training session, there was an incident with Sal, who didn't understand why Caridad was uninterested in accompanying him on an overnight trip to South Beach. He held her elbow too firmly, his teeth bared, wet. He loved to recline on the weight bench, spreading his legs wide. He always wore loose shorts and no underwear during their sessions, letting his limp cock hang lazily against his left thigh. No matter how much weight he lifted, he grunted extravagantly. Caridad pretended not to notice. He stood too close to her now, a fluffy white towel draped around his neck. Sal pressed a fat finger against the base of her throat, making Caridad feel choked. "You will be well compensated. We'll dance. Maybe more," he said. Caridad's face burned, but she bit her tongue. The job was good, mostly. She pushed Sal away, negotiating the complexity of making her point without getting fired. "I'm only here to help make bodies better. My body isn't for sale." Sal snorted, said,
"We'll see about that,"
as he walked away. Caridad lived with her boyfriend Manny in a loud, stuccoed apartment complex in Bonita Springs. They had been dating for 4 years, and their relationship was mostly unremarkable. She was smart enough to want more, but tired enough to accept the way things were. When Caridad came home, Manny was stretching on the living room floor, bare-chested, wearing soccer shorts, knee-high socks, cleats. He played in a local league, and his team, Los Toreadores, practiced every evening. They were the most menacing team in the area. Sometimes they even traveled around the state, playing teams from other leagues. There were rumors, for example, that scouts from professional teams spied on their practices, but nothing ever came of it. That didn't stop the men on the team from dreaming of wearing a Galaxy jersey, or maybe the colors of a European team. Manchester United. Real Madrid. When Caridad complained, Manny shrugged, said, "This is who I am, babe. I'm a footballer." Caridad knelt between his taut, open thighs and pushed Manny onto his back. She lay on his chest and exhaled loudly. "I've had the worst day," she said. Manny lightly massaged her shoulders and Caridad tensed. "Just let me lie here," she whispered. Manny gently pushed her to the side, kissed her forehead, said, "I've gotta go." Caridad stared at a curving pattern of mold on the ceiling as he stood. She stared for a long time. After practice, Manny looked contrite, his dark hair clinging damply to the edges of his face. His jersey was soaked. He kissed her forehead again, tried to ask Caridad about her day, but she no longer had any interest in telling him anything. The entrance to their complex was lined with palm trees. At night, the trees were illuminated in pink and yellow and blue and green. Caridad loved sitting beneath the lights, found them unspeakably beautiful.
Caridad grabbed Manny's hand and led him outside. They sat quietly beneath the trees for a few moments. Then Manny leaned into Caridad, pawed at her breasts, tried to work his fingers beneath the waistband of her denim skirt. She laughed. Her lilting voice drifting upward as she swatted his hands away said, "Not yet, baby, not yet. Just be with me. Just be nice with me." But Manny didn't hear her, or wouldn't hear her. Caridad was too tired to fight too much. She stretched her arms over her head as Manny lay over her, pushing Caridad's skirt up around her slender hips. He kissed her left thigh, said something unimportant. The pink light was of an exceptional quality. Caridad smiled, relished the quiet thrill. 4411, Palmetto Pines Way. At first, news of the brothel was only a rumor. Men would rush into and out of the spa in Palmetto, landing at all hours, often looking harried on the way in and relaxed on the way out, but we had no proof. Then, Evelyn Marshall caught her husband getting a blowjob. She was getting a hot stone massage and heard a familiar groan from the adjacent room. News spread through our small community quickly. But no one alerted the authorities. We felt important, having such goings-on in our midst. In the afternoon, the therapists often sit on the large lanai behind the spa in negligees and peignoirs and heavy makeup, smoking and drinking bright-colored fruity drinks, waiting for their next clients. My front balcony looks out onto this lanai where the ladies lounge. They are not as beautiful as you might imagine, but they are interesting and they talk loudly. They never seem to sweat, despite the humidity. Their voices are deep and velvety, in the way of women who know things. I sit on my balcony most afternoons wearing a pair of dark sunglasses. I hold a book in my lap. I pretend to read. One of the women who work at the spa is very tall, the kind of tall in a woman that makes people stare. She has long, dark hair. She always wears down. She is beautiful, and I love looking at her, how she moves, the anger in her eyes. She caught me staring once, stood up, her robe falling open. She lifted a leg and propped it on the railing and pointed between her thighs, then threw her hands in the air. I did not stop staring. She did not close her legs. I went to see her. The woman at the desk studied me carefully. She said, "Nadia is one of our special therapists. She charges high fees." I said, "I know." The receptionist shrugged. Soon after, I was escorted into the back. I heard interesting sounds. Nadia had a thick Russian accent, but spoke English well.
"You want massage? Candles?"
"What?" she asked. I said, "I wanna fuck." The words felt heavy and strange in my mouth. Nadia cocked her head to the side.
"You are different," she said.
Later, her tongue was cool and soft between my thighs. I twisted my fingers through her hair, resting my heels on her back. I wanted to explain myself. It took me a long time to come, it always does. But Nadia was patient. I reciprocated her attentions. I wasn't afraid. As I was leaving, I ran into my next-door neighbor. She pulled her purse closer to her body and looked away. I pressed my hand against my neighbor's shoulder as we passed. She still refused to look at me, but she leaned into my touch. Now, Nadia stares at me when she's on her lanai, and I am up on my balcony. I don't look away. My husband calls me a wildcat. After we make love, he always whistles under his breath and slaps my thigh, says, "Goddamn, woman, you're going to kill me." On our wedding day, my mother pulled me aside at the chapel. I was only half-dressed,
walking around in white pantyhose, a corset, and white patent leather heels. My dress was a monstrosity of satin and chiffon, and I wanted to wear it for as little time as possible. We stood in a dark vestibule, and my mother began straightening my curls, pulling them out of my face, messing with the pearl headband holding my hair back. She said, "There's no mystery to keeping a man." She dabbed at my lipstick with a tissue she'd been holding, folded in the palm of her hand. She said, "You do whatever sick thing he wants, when he wants, and you'll never have a problem." That was the only advice she has ever given me. She and my father divorced when I was 9. 1217 Ridgewood Road, Unit 23. Tricia cleaned houses, and she was good at it. Knew just how to work her way through someone's home to deal with the messes they didn't want to take responsibility for. Tricia loved to talk with her clients. That's how she judged people. If they ignored her or were clipped in their responses, she knew they weren't good people and didn't feel bad about availing herself of some of their possessions. Little things they would never miss because they had too much. Tricia wore tank tops and denim cut-off shorts while she worked, leaving her tanned arms and long legs bare. She wore her dirty blonde hair on top of her head, a few loose strands wispy against her neck. Sweat often pooled between her breasts, leaving a damp line down the middle of her shirt. This did not concern Tricia. She was proud to work so hard, her effort left a mark. The wives Tricia worked for didn't appreciate Tricia's comfort with her body and her labor, particularly if their husbands were home. They took it as something of an insult. A woman who cleaned their homes, had such a naturally fine body while they stretched themselves taut with the finest surgeons in South Florida and didn't look half as good? It wasn't fair. Money was supposed to make things fair. Tricia cleaned very big houses, the kinds with rooms that had special designations like media room and fitness center and library. The floors were often marble, and when the women who lived in these houses walked, their heels click-click-clacked. Most of the women who cleaned houses in the area were brown-skinned and spoke Spanish or Creole. Tricia was something of a novelty, and her services were in high demand because her clients liked having an English-speaking housekeeper, as much as it made them uncomfortable to see a white woman doing the work of la gente. Once in a while, the wives asked Tricia where she was from, and Tricia explained her people were from the Everglades. Generations of her family lived deep in the swamp, so deep you had to take an airboat to get to their land, where their homes were all stucco and mold and wide-open windows. The way Tricia said this, it was like she was saying something more, but the wives were never quite sure what. La Negra Blanca. At the club, Sarah goes by Sierra. The manager gave her the name the day she was hired 4 years earlier. He asked if she had a preference, but she shrugged. Took a sip of warm soda, told him to knock himself out. He looked her up and down and up again.
"Sierra," he said. "So you turn your head when your name is called."
Sometimes when she's opening the refrigerator or reaching into a drawer for a pair of shorts, Sarah will catch herself swiveling her hips and arching her back. Even when she's not on the pole, she's dancing around it. She takes a lot of Advil because even at home, she's always hearing the thump-thump-thump of the bass line. Candy, her best friend at work, took one look at Sarah on her first day and told Sarah to dance to black girl booty-shaking music because guys love to see white girls with juicy asses shake their stuff. Sarah blushed, then pivoted to get a better look at her ass. She said, "My ass is juicy." Candy laughed and grabbed a handful of Sarah's ass. But Sarah already knew she had a juicy ass and where it came from. Her mother is black, and her father is white. But for years, people have assumed she's a white girl because she has green eyes and straight blonde hair. She's not ashamed of who she is. But in Baltimore, it's easier to be a white girl with a black girl's ass